Since 1995, basically since the Kollel began. I'm Rabbi Ingush, and I've met you before. And what we're going to do every night, every Sunday night, is we're going to speak a little bit about a certain topic. One night about Talmud Torah, one night about Tefillah, one night about Eretz Yisrael. Maybe we'll have a niggun or something. We'll see how close we get. First night, we've got to break the ice, and it's very, everyone's just getting to meet one another. And I want you guys to have a chance also to ask some questions and have give and take, because I know that this is a year, especially the boys who are in high school, that you're going through a lot of what you are, what does it mean to be a Ben Torah, what does Kollel mean, and all these types of questions. So if you guys have some questions, it's a nice opportunity to get. It doesn't have to be on the topic we spoke about. It could be on any topic, okay? So tonight, we're going to talk about Talmud Torah. We'll start talking about Talmud Torah. And I'm going to ask the following question. Why do we spend so much time learning Torah? If you just tell people, I'm a religious person, I'm working on a religious program, Shem Lechem of Israeli, so you think, come on in. So you think, oh, you're religious, you're out there helping people, building ditches, saving people's lives, healing them, taking care of the needy. Like, I understand, I got to learn the Torah because I have to keep Hashem's mitzvahs. Part of being Ovid Hashem is obeying the Rabbanu Shel Olam and knowing what to do. But today is art scroll. Just open up an art scroll, it'll take you two hours and you get to know all the mitzvahs. Why we spend so much time? You're going to meet such great people this summer. And the greatest minds throughout history, all they want to do, if I could stop the world and not have to do anything else, and I've been around the block a few times, and I know this world, all I want to do with my time is just get lost in a Gemara. And it seems so esoteric, and it seems important, but like, why should I? Because you're starting on that road, and the more you understand why you're doing it, the more you can get psyched and get enthusiastic about doing it. So we're going to talk about tonight a little bit, why learn Torah? Why is Torah so important? I'll talk about 15, 20 minutes, I hope. Hard for me to stop talking. Then we'll have some questions and answers, okay? Here's the issue, guys, okay? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is so different from us that our minds are not able to understand it. And I'm going to prove it to you. I'm going to say three definitions, three qualities of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I'm going to ask you to envision those qualities. And you'll see that we're totally, totally unqualified to try to understand a Kodesh Baruch with our own minds. Okay, here's the first mental experiment. I'm going to say a word, close your eyes, and associate that word with an image. You ready? Here it goes. One, two, three. Infinity. Now, half of you are the math geeks, and you're doing that little infinity sign. We know who you are, right? Okay, what's your name, math geek?
Kiva.
Okay, so Kiva's a math geek. Most of the rest of you are doing the Star Wars introduction, right? The beginning of the movie, the George Lucas. Guys, neither is infinity. Yours is just a metaphor, and a symbol. And the big black space in the Star Wars is called large finitude, but it's framed. There's a beginning, and there's an end. You know what? No human being alive can describe infinity to you, because our minds aren't wired that way. Our minds think in structures. There's a beginning, and there's an end. So try to stretch your mind, stretch your imagination. You're just stretching, but you're not going beyond a certain limit. You could keep stretching it. So Kadosh Baruch Hu is infinite. What does that even mean? Here's another thing, okay? Kadosh Baruch Hu is non-physical. You know anything that's non-physical? Air may seem non-physical when you break it down. There's chemicals, molecules, is that it? Everything's what's about Hashem is not physical. What's going to have a being that has no physical reference point? An idea is not, Hashem's not an idea. Jim's a being. Jim's something that exists. How can I describe? Everything that exists has some material to it. Has some makeup to it. Baruch Hu doesn't have any makeup. Here's a third word, okay? Get ready. Hashem is infinite. Hashem is non-physical. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu is indivisible. You can't break him down. There's one. When we say Hashem is Echad, we mean he can't be broken. There's nothing that you can describe to me that I can't break down to smaller parts. You see the shtender? I can break it down to molecules. I can take those molecules and break them down to atoms. I can take those atoms and break them down to quarks and protons. And the last century, you proved how much energy you release when you break and smash atoms. You can destroy the world. And you want to take a person, I can break it down to conscience and subconscious and preconscience and body and soul and spirit. And there is nothing, everything in our world is a combination and a clustering of smaller things into larger things. Including us. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not that way. So he's infinite, he's not physical, and he's indivisible. Good luck trying to describe him. You don't even have the vocabulary. There is no word, not a person or words. I think about words a lot. I write a lot of words. There is no word in any language that can describe Hashem unless you put one word before it, and then every word can describe Hashem. This is the secret to understanding Hashem. There's one word that applies to Hashem, and if you put it before any other word, it can capture HaKadosh Baruch. You know what that word is in English?
No.
It's called Na. He's not tall, he's not short, he's not hot, he's not cold, he's not tasty. Because every word that I can generate comes from my experience, and Hashem has nothing to do with human experience. And that's why throughout history, people always try to define HaKadosh Baruch Hu in human terms. They want to feel close to it. You want to feel something you can reach, something you could. To the ancient people, what do they feel God was? They felt HaKadosh Baruch Hu was, I don't know, seasons and forests and rivers and animals, because that's what they came in contact with. The North American Indians, I asked Ben and Jerry, people we stole the land from, right? In North American Indians, they worshiped the bears and the seasons. Okay, so people start to get a little more sophisticated and start worshiping the planets, because the planets felt as if they were powerful. They had some contact with them because they determined our biorhythm. Guys, now we said the COVID-19. You know what the clinical term for flu is? Anyone know? Why do we call it the flu?
Influenza.
Influenza, why? Because they thought that the flu was caused by the influence of the planets. When the planets orbit a certain way, they cause an infection. Look at the irony. People thought that these large planets in space caused flus, and we know it to be a virus. Which is even smaller than a bacteria, because it doesn't have its own homeostasis, because it has to leech off of its host. Just to show you how rickety science is. Today's science is tomorrow's optic. Don't ever be afraid of science, guys. Spell science with a small s, not a capital S. We have to respect science. We have to utilize science. It's a gift that Kodesh Baruch Hu gave us. But science is frozen in a certain moment of time, and who knows where we're heading. Everything we know now can be disproven tomorrow, because we just started to map the human mind, we started to map the universe, and we think we know, 1892 or 1887, the French patent minister, 1897, made an announcement. We can close the office. 1897, why? Because everything that needs to be invented has already been invented. It's a mockery. Don't be too arrogant with science. Use science, study science, trust science, but don't idolize it. Don't worship it. That's not where truth lies. Science helps us understand our world and has given us control of our world, but it can't build faith. Doesn't help you with relationships. Doesn't help you with identity. There's a whole world out there that science is totally incapable of helping with. So we have to use science, but not deify it, not idolize it. So as human beings went through history, they tried to define Hashem in human terms, because how can you have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu? You can't even begin to describe him. I don't have a word to describe him. No one can describe him. That's why makes Yiddishkeit so powerful. Because on the one hand, we've stood tall throughout history, refusing to allow even small humanizations of Hashem, because that's really what Christianity did. Christianity said, well, you know, we'll have both ways. God himself is unknowable, beyond, surpassing, invisible, yeah. But his son, that son, he was physical, he was born from a woman's womb, you can hold him and paint him and sculpt him and curse him and curse him with his name, Jesus, is that equal? Because how can you have a religion? How can you have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu? You can't define him. And our legacy is, how many people in this room, every single person in this room has a grandparent somehow over the last 2,000 years of that relationship. There is blood running through this room. And none of you or none of us would be here if we didn't have the courage throughout history to stand tall in the face of a world that was dark, that hated us, that challenged us because we challenged them, because we defied their slip into paganism. We said Hashem isn't physical, Hashem is non-knowable, you might can't, and still we love Hashem, and I love him so much that I'm willing to die for him, even though I can't taste him, see him, describe him, define him. That's Mesiras Nefesh, that's the Mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem. So that's the problem that we face is Avdei Hashem. It's not a problem, but the solution is the moment. As Avdei Hashem, we want to know Hashem, we want to have a relationship with Hashem, we want to feel his presence, we want to daven to him, we want to become a chassadim. Like, there's so many ways I want to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but at the end of the day, who is he? I want to be like him, I want to be a Baal Chassad. Okay, that's the way to get close to Hashem. I want to daven to him, that's the way to get close to Hashem. Believe me, I want to live in this country. I've dedicated my life to live in this country. I'm not looking for an easy life, I'm looking for a life of history, because I think Hashem wants me here. And I know he wants me here. And you know what? You know who else wants me here? You guys want me here. Because one day you'll either be here, or your children will be here, or your grandchildren will be here. So someone's got to be here. Someone's got to build the infrastructure. Someone's got to struggle and iron out this world. You can't just wait for Mashiach to come and create a magic carpet. We have to build the future as best we can. I don't know that we'll build it entirely. I don't know if we'll be fully successful. But I know one thing, my footprints and my fingerprints will be all over that world when Mashiach comes. And I will have raised my family here and tried to build the receiving party, the welcome party for Mashiach and for Melech HaMashiach. So those are all the ways I try to close HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But at the end of the day, who is this HaKadosh Baruch Hu? You just said, Baranachnu Karim or Mishnah Chavim Umodim. Here's a question, but before you answer it, if you have an answer, you're a kofer. When you said, Baranachnu Karim or Mishnah Chavim Umodim, what image do you have in your head? Please don't answer the question. Because if you have an image, you're a kofer. What do you think?
Would it be incorrect to make a cloud of Shekhinah?
That's good. Which is why, right, the only image in Tanakh for Hashem's presence is a cloud. Because the cloud is distorted vision rather than clarity. Because we can't see Hashem. He's got the greatest irony. The sharpest image of Hashem in Tanakh, so the cloud comes by. Because the cloud comes down and says, you can't see me. Ki ve'anan ariel kapar. So you can't understand me. What? The bush is not Hashem. Hashem is in the bush. He's called from the bush. The only, guys, I'll tell you something a little bit sophisticated, you got to follow it from its light. The only image that we have of Hashem, not the bush, because Hashem is speaking to Moshe from the bush, and the cloud, because you don't see imagery, but it's a rainbow. Anyone know the physics of a rainbow? How does a rainbow work?
It's sun's reflection.
It says it's a prism to break light and to show you all the colors of the spectrum. One second. Now, why can't you see those colors under normal conditions? Because when you have all the colors of the spectrum, it's invisible. So the rainbow breaks light every once in a while to show you, to teach you a lesson that sometimes something is invisible, not because it doesn't exist, but because it's everything, and therefore you can't see it. Does that remind you of anything? What's invisible because it's everything and you can't see it? That's why the Keshet is Hashem. Because the Keshet, the rainbow, teaches you that sometimes you don't see it because it's the totality. I see my shirt as white because all the white parts of your shirt is black, and all the black parts of the spectrum being absorbed, and the rest is being repelled. Where you have to see, here you're not seeing anything because it's all the colors of the spectrum. That's why it's in the image of Hashem, because it's everything, that's why you don't really see it, because he's Bako Mikoko. He's everything. So what did you say? What's your name?
Shirishan.
Yeah, Shirishan.
Didn't we see an image of Hashem on Torah?
We didn't see an image. Absolutely. No images.
Absolutely.
Of course. We saw fire, we saw smoke. We saw an infernal mountain. The whole purpose of our Sinai, auditory, not visual. We're an auditory people. We think, we hear, we speak, very, very limited on the visuals. We have some very, very basic, abstract visuals. We walk into the shul, see a lot of metaphors, a lot of symbols. Because sounds are always more abstract than visuals and pictures. That's why if you're addicted to movies, try to break it as quickly as you can. You think you're learning from movies. You can open up any book in your library and get more from one page in that book than 5 minutes with it. Because visuals trap your imagination in a particular image. So they're like, listen to a song, you enjoy hearing a song, then you look at the video or something, and then you're trapped in that image. I have to stream the emotions of the song through that video, rather than listening to music, which evokes multiple emotions at once and allows your emotions to run free. So when you have a picture's like a stamp you lock it in. But we're not a people of pictures. We're people of sounds. Like in Parshas, of course, is no picture. Which part of the sound? Yes, both.
In Parshas Noach, we said Hashem shows Noach a rainbow. So he's really showing him himself.
It's a machlok. Some say the rainbow is representative of the bris that Hashem made with Noach. But some Rishonim say the rainbow actually, in its Parshas and the Pesukim, represents Hashem. Because it represents Hashem, because the only way to represent Hashem is through invisibility.
Why is it?
I think it was Zohar, but Hashem was rebooting the world, and Hashem rebooting the world had to remind the world because they had went a moral freefall. They were cheating on each other, stealing each other's wives, killing each other. I don't know, Rishon heard Hashem. He heard Hashem is Halakha Dochada. So this isn't a reward for Noach. Hashem is rebooting the world through Noach. Hashem must remind humanity, see me, even though I'm not here.
I'm saying, when humanity was in the
ceremony,
they never saw Hashem.
No one ever saw Hashem.
I'm saying they never even saw it. Like,
they never saw the rainbow. And that was what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was trying to reboot the world. But they didn't see Hashem. They didn't understand that he's there in the background. And they fell into a moral collapse. So he's reminding people, I'm watching you. There's a surveillance. You have to abide by the moral law. So here's the problem. Let's bring it together. Here's the problem. How do I get close to Hashem? I can't even describe him. I can't even know him. Here's the answer. Torah is the word of Hashem and the word of Hashem. And the more Torah I know, the more I understand his chacham. And the more his chacham I understand, the closer I am to it. And that's why Torah will always be superior to philosophy. Some people like philosophy, some people don't like philosophy, for some people it enhances, for some people it just deters. But Rav Moshe Feinstein will always know Hashem more than Albert Einstein. Because Albert Einstein is trying to reverse engineer Hashem based on his universe. And you can. You certainly can. But it's not as direct as studying the religion. Let's say you had never met. Let's say I couldn't come to some. And you want to get to know me. So you could go to my house or at home. Look around my house, look at my furniture, look at my story, look at my backyard, look at what's in my fridge, and say, well, based on the fact that he built this house, or raised this family, or painted this picture, whatever, I can see what his likes are and dislikes are. What if you could submit 10 questions to me? What if you could submit 10,000 questions to me? What if you could submit 100,000? What if you could submit endless amounts of questions about what my will is about everything in life? You would know me a lot better than just poking around my house, or tasting my chocolate cake, or looking at the things that I create. And the problem is, until you see enough of a massive Torah, you don't see it. Because you just, it's like me telling you, have you ever heard of Michelangelo, the great artist of the Sistine Chapel? I want to tell you how brilliant he was. I go to Rome, and when no one's watching, I climb up with a chair, and I watch that the guard's not watching, and I take a little bit of blue paint from the ceiling, and I bring it back and say, here's Michelangelo's brilliance. So it's a piece of blue chip paint that he's showing me. When I put that chip into the Sistine Chapel, to the ceiling, and you see the beauty and the context, and you see the whole sweep, they say, oh, that's brilliant. That's amazing. So until you see enough Torah, it's hard to say, why is this? This seems techno. This seems like two oxes. This seems like contracts. Yeah, but if you learn 100,000 details about contracts, and you're able to abstract not just the law, but what the concepts are, because that's what Lundus does. Lundus is looking, if you're watching me, Lundus takes your head like this and says, don't look at the details, look at the category. Don't look at the specifics. It's called induction. What is this halacha show you? What are you guys learning Megillah now? So you're learning Kriya Satara? What is the halacha of Amida? Show you about Kriya Satara. How do we define Kriya Satara? Once you have categories, so let's say you want to know Hashem's rule about marriage. So you can take a cup of coffee and have a conversation. What do you think Hashem's rule about marriage is? Or you can learn which five masechtas you want to learn about marriage. How to make a marriage. Surrogate marriage, when a brother steps into someone else's marriage, dismantling a marriage, contracts a marriage, and betraying marriage. Now, the problem is each of those is a portal into years and years and years and years of learning, not just to know the details, but to get to the concepts, and why did Hashem give this halacha, and what do you mean by this halacha, and what is this halacha sub to show me, what is this halacha given show me, and I promise you, you could spend an entire lifetime on each of those six. On each of those six, and that's just within one sector. But if you walked away and you spent an entire lifetime in each of the six, you live six lifetimes, and you know what? One day you will. And one day, you'll have endless time. And that world we call Olam Haba. In that world, nothing from this world, and I mean nothing, zero, nada, nothing from this world makes it to the next world. The only thing in this world that makes it to the next world is Torah, is the rule of Hashem. And you have no time, and no limitations, and you're never tired, and you're never hungry, because you don't have a body, and there's no sports, and there's no culture, and there's no movies, and all you'll do for eternity, in ways that I can't explain to you, because no one's been back, but the way that Chazal tells us, you will engage in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's knowledge and will, and you'll feel that closest to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's why Talmud Torah is so central, because it is the closest, not the only way, but it's the closest approximation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in human terms. It's the closest I can get to know. If you ask me, who is HaKadosh Baruch Hu to me? I've had a long life, Baruch Hashem. There have been many ways that I try to meet him, many parts of my life that I find him. But the core of my identity is all the Torah that I've learned and the knowledge that I've accrued of him, because I can't describe it in my own terms. And that's why I want to warn you, especially the 11th graders, and anyone who's the 11th graders, you're starting on this journey. So first of all, you need to trust. If you're not into learning yet, you're not excited, you're not enthusiastic, look at your madrichim. Look at the rabbeim. To get forward in life. And that's why this generation is facing such hardships. To get forward in life, listen to me carefully, you have to go to the unknown. By definition, if you stay where you are and you hold on to your security blankets, you're not moving forward. To get forward, you have to go somewhere you're not. And that's the story of Avram, Lachlecha le'aretzchem lachlecha le'zavicha. I came to this country in 1983, way before you were born, from Brooklyn, not knowing anyone, landing on some hilltop in the middle of Gush changed my life. Went to a country I didn't know, language I didn't speak, people I didn't know, and all of a sudden I found, hit the jackpot. This is the life I want to lead. These are the values of the decade. And my knees were wobbling getting on that plane. And then 10 years later, I made Aliyah, knees wobbling, butterflies in my stomach. Don't ever walk away from those decisions. Those are the formative decisions in your life, when your knees are wobbling and your butterflies are in your stomach. Because your knees aren't wobbling and your butterflies aren't in your stomach, you're standing in your safe zone. If you stay in your safe zone, you're going to be mediocre, because you're never going to move to the next great thing. Now, the question is, how do you move to the next great thing? How do you find that when there's so much fear and uncertainty? The answer is the T word. And it's so scarce in our world. It's called trust. You have to find people in this world that you can look in the eye and get to know them and say, you know what? I trust this person. I listen to this person. I model myself after this person. Here's a mental experiment. And don't, I'm not asking you to raise your hands. Is there anyone in this world that you trust deeply? And that you would follow blindly after, I know I met my Rebbe of Arnold Lichtenstein, got on the door, I trusted him blindly. He said things, I didn't always agree with them, but I followed them because I trusted him. And the problem is in our world, there's a lot of distrust because everything we think is proven to be otherwise. And our athletes turn out to be who knows what, and the politicians turn out to be who knows what, and our celebrities turn out to be who knows what. It's really hard to build trust. But when you meet people this summer and they say, you know, Torah is the way I access HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and you may not be that excited, not yet, but you're starting, so you know what? Like, even if you don't learn up a storm this summer, if you just bottle up that experience and you know what, I met people and I'm impressed by them, and maybe I'm in 11th grade and maybe I'm in 10th grade, wherever you guys are, and but I really, when you, if you had met me in 1981, let's say, and you walked down the street in Brooklyn, I wasn't carrying a Gemara. I wasn't a learner over the summer. I was bowling. But in the back of my mind, I said, I want to be a Talmid Chacham one day. I'll get to it when I get to Yeshiva. No, I wasn't learning in high school. It's a pretty serious level. It's like my whole preoccupation. It was the normal things. But in the deep, deep part of my identity, I really wanted to be a Talmid Chacham. And if you carry that away from this summer, that's more important than any pages you learn, how many books you turn, how much this vision that you guys can become something. You guys can not just be good guys and go through the process. And who's going to be a Talmid Chacham? Who's going to be a big Talmid Chacham in this room? Who's going to be someone you leave this world, your grandchildren quoting you and learning your Svarim and saying over your Torah and you're sitting at a Seder table? And so that's what you need to succeed. You need trust. Finding people that tell you, a lot of times guys ask me when they apply to yeshiva, I used to be more involved in admissions to the yeshiva, so I got this question all the time. Rebbe, I'm not sure I want to learn. Should I come to Nush? So I always tell them, I say, well, let me give you the following test. If I took, I had a little aspirin, I had a hard day today, so I said, let's say take a pill, put it on the table. Let's say you take that pill, and miraculously you're going to want to learn. Would you take it? Honest. Be honest with me. Be honest with yourself. No heroism. Coming to shoot, it doesn't fit you. Would you take the pill? If you take the pill, then even if you don't want to learn, it shows that you want to learn. Because you're taking the pill. And then you'll be fine, because you come to yeshiva, you get swept up in the enthusiasm, the environment, the energy of the people. If you're not sure you want to take the pill, this isn't the place for you. Because it's not like you don't want to learn, you don't even want to learn, and there are better yeshivas that will help you get to that stage. Because you're at that pre-want-to-want. As far as I'm concerned, if you want to want it, and just you hold back in high school, but test and culture, friends and family, whatever else, okay. Come to yeshiva, take the pill, you'll be fine. That's trust. And the second thing you have to be careful about, listen carefully, because you guys are starting to build your identity. If any rabbi uses the following word, walk out the door. That's what it's there for. Any rabbi says, this is the emes, he's a comedian, not a rabbi. Because it's a funny joke. Because it doesn't exist. Because Hashem is too broad to be captured by anyone's mind. It's impossible. Impossible. It would have been the worst thing about Hashem. It doesn't exist. The human mind isn't capable of fully encompassing Hashem. That's not just a manipulative statement. It's a bankrupt statement. It's amoratsis. If the Rebbe uses the following term, you should follow him if that's the Rebbe. As far as you, this is my access. Oh, that's a different story. This is the way I access Hashem. This is the way I get close to Hashem. Same thing with Torah. Another word you should be careful of. Rebbe says, this is the derech. That's another joke. The derech, the learn Torah. Who's your name this year, William? Okay. Let me ask you a question, Mr. Stand up, that's it, okay? As a baron, as a rose one sure, I live with him, the wife, as matters, and me and my Rosenzweig are very similar there. Obviously, you might mention that. How many more shows did Rabbi Rosenzweig teach you this year? Zero or one? Okay, zero. Why? Because the Marsha dealt with issues of a sugya that people like Rabbi Rosenzweig, my friend, I maybe taught one this year also, don't deal with. Do you know what would happen if the Marsha walked in that door right now? I'd run over, throw myself on the ground, and roll in his dust. Because he knew more Torah in the little white of his pinky than I'll ever know in my entire life. But I have a problem. I'm only going to live one life in this world. And with the limited time I have to study, I wish I could live a million lives. I'd study all the Shas the Marsha's way, and study all the Shas the Yom Shoshama's way, and study all the Shas the Kanashima's way, and study all the Shas the Marsha's way, but I only have one life. And I have to make a hard decision. In that one life, with the limited time I have available to learn Torah, I'm not trying to save the world. What access point do I want to choose? What style do I think? Intellectually, emotionally, religiously, however you make that decision, how am I going to access Hashem's Torah in the limited time I have? And that's called my derech, not the derech. You hear the difference? My emes, not the emes. Be careful. Listen to the way we speak. There's no one emes. The Gemara says in Titus, and in the end of days, Hashem aligns all the tzaddikim in a circle. And Hashem is occupying the midpoint. He stands in the middle. And all the tzaddikim on the perimeter, they're saying, Zeh Hashem kivinolo. Like, you know, this is Hashem, we waited for him. Come on, guys, we'll study geometry. Why is the final lineup of the tzaddikim a circle, not a square, not a triangle, not a rectangle? What makes the circle geometrically unique?
Each point is equal to distance, etc.
Okay, 90% there.
It's because Hashem is in the center, everyone's in equal radius.
Infinite equidistant radius. You can draw an infinite amount of equidistant radius from the midpoint to the circle. So let's say, I'm just using my kippah as an example. Let's say all of us, more or less in this room, are here in the circle. This is part of the circle we're at. But we have differences in the room. We're all more or less the same hashkafa, the same world. And let's say, I don't know, a breast of a chassid walked in now, with the peos and the singing, and who knows what. And he'd be on this part of the circle, where my bottom hand is. Who would be seeing more of Hashem? Even though we're 180 degrees diametrically opposed. Because we're seeing Hashem totally different. Because no human being can grasp the totality of Hashem. Now, are the human beings that see more of Hashem in their style? Of course, those are the great people. They have to see more of Hashem. But you want to cling to those. Thank God, I discussed a lot of great people in my life who saw so much of Hashem and endowed that sweep of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not listening. That's guys why we stand up. Because otherwise we're lost in the flood. Otherwise we're just lost in the wind. I can try to describe Hashem, I can try, and that's why we thank Hashem, Mishra Bakra Lari Bikalam, Vanessa Lanos Terasa. And we study Pharaoh, and we perform mitzvahs. Because we believe that the mitzvahs are not just arbitrary. No mitzvahs are arbitrary. We don't understand. There's some logic to Bar Aviva. There's some logic to Shabbos. There's some logic to Chazir. There's some logic to Basu B'Challah. Even though I can't explain any of those to you, and Shalom Nach can explain Bar Aviva, we believe that Kihen Chagin V'Yerachimim, which gives a command that it's good for me, it's good for our Neshama, it's good for our life, at some level I can't begin to explain to you. So he gave us mitzvahs, he gave us Torah, and I try to couple together some relationship with him as best as I can. And then everything starts to lighten up, like some big TV on the side. Oh, now I know I'm dominating through, now I know I'm chesed, I try to be like, now I know why I want to live in this land. Torah's the hub. Torah's at that hub. So that's why we study so much. And you know what I just told you? Very few people ever think about. They just walk into the world of studying Torah. Until you understand the problem, you understand the solution. Until you understand that you can't understand Hashem, you don't realize how powerful Torah is because that's our ticket to understand that first part. That's why we study Torah. Okay? Questions? What's your name? Like,
my name is Avram Gladder.
Okay, it can be on Torah, it can be on anything you guys want. Go ahead, Avram.
So if we know that we can't fully understand Hashem, isn't that going to like make people just be like, why am I learning at all? I can't fully understand Hashem, I won't learn at all.
Okay, you're right. That's a really good question.
Like, how do people push themselves to learn if it's like so little, like compared to how much of Hashem there is to learn?
Because you can either, it's a great question, Avram, you can either degrade an experience based on accomplishment. Let me give you an example, okay? Let's say you're a swimmer.
Sure, a little bit.
Okay, let's say I told you you could swim a lap in an Olympic-sized pool, or I'll take two boats out to the middle Pacific Ocean, I'll put them at a distance that measures the same as an Olympic-sized pool, and you can swim for both of the other words you choose. I would choose the Pacific Ocean, so there's no sharks.
Yeah.
They're coming into contact with so much more, even though I'm covering the same amount of cubic space of water, and I'm part of something larger. So sometimes you gain experience, not just by what you process in your own personal world, but you know, I once visited a glacier. So if you measure the amount of ice I walked on, it wasn't that, but I knew I was standing on a piece of ice the size of a continent, the size of the United States of America, or whatever, a small continent. And it was breathtaking to me. So on the definition of chasing something that you'll never reach, on the one end could get frustrated because you'll never reach it, the other end, the reason you're not reaching it is because it's something beyond you. Like when you look at the ocean, you ever get a across the ocean with your feet, with you swimming? No. Do you enjoy standing by the ocean? Because you feel drawn to something beyond yourself. And there's something beyond you, and that's where our souls and our neshamas feel like we're going somewhere else. It's like, you're right, my kids used to ask me when I was young, I'll be ever going to finish the storm on yourself. I said, no, I never planned to. That's not my interest. I don't want to cover pages. I want to try to drill down to as much of our Hashem's knowledge as I can. And it takes a bit of a shift because we're very accomplishment based in our culture. The marks and the scores and the folders and the movement, rather than saying if you want to chase something, let me tell you my sweetest moment in Talmud Torah. Sometimes I work and I work and I work on a circuit and I put sometimes 7 or 8 hours into my shiur. And very often I'm hitting brick walls and I have to stop and pull back and go back to it again. And I'm drilling and I'm drilling and I'm drilling and I'm organizing and organizing and organizing. And then at a certain point, I realize that if I go one step forward in the circuit, I'm going to lose everything I've accomplished because my mind is just going to explode. And I know there are angles in the sugya that are starting to open up in front of my eyes, but just say stop. Just stop. And if you go one step further, you lose the clarity of what you've accomplished before. And that I call the moment of sweet surrender. That's my sweetest moment. It's a moment of incapability, not a moment of capability. I'm excited because I'm incapable of touching Hashem. I'm seeing HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because I'm not seeing Hashem until I'm not capable of seeing it on my own. As long as I'm seeing it on my own, I'm seeing Moshe Darabin's. I'm not seeing the total sweep of Moshe's. When I push myself beyond the limits, now I'm seeing something that's like a spark. And I feel a buzz in my neshama, but it's not in my head. Because I know my head can't go further. Because I'm wounded. But I know that I'm coming into contact with the spark. Cue lawyer on the other side. That's what I said about Moshe. You can't see me, right? You can't see me. Yes. Awesome.
How does one get from a point of learning to get an accomplishment to a point where he's learning to get closer to Hashem?
How do we mean how do you?
And people like finishing sentences. People like finishing shots.
It doesn't have to be here. Some people, but even when you finish shots, you're only going to know. You're not going to know it the same way you know math because it's endless. So the next run through, you're going to go a little deeper. So you're saying you want to accent Bikias as opposed to you. That's fine. Even people that learn Eon learn Bikias, because as much Eon as you learn, you're only starting to crack the surface. People ask me, what you doing in Bikias Eon? I learned what people would call Eon all day. But if you held it relative to what people before me do, I'm just barely scratching the surface of the sugya. So I learned Bikias also. So it's not like a binary yes or no. Are you learning Bikias or Eon? It's a cursor. And you decide how much of the cursor you want to move towards in depth and how much of the cursor you know. So that's not grading people how in depth you're learning or not in depth you're learning. It's all Hashem's Torah. You're the Alephase of what Hashem's Torah. Torah has multiple access points. You have to find your groove of this, so you'll find a yeshiva to go to and your band. And by and large, most of the yeshivas that you guys will go to, by and large, are going to stress Eon as the main menu. Slight differences, some yeshivas are more along this, some yeshivas are less, but by and large, you are going to have a healthy, balanced diet between trying to cover ground. Remember something. See, the problem is, when you have your stories about the old yeshivas and Slobodka and Mir and Volozhin, these were yeshivas, they didn't have guys your age. These yeshivas were full of 12, 13, and 14-year-olds. There's no high school. So when you're 12 or 13 years old, you went by Zaidi, told me, that he remembers arriving in Volozhin on a snowy day, couple months after his bar mitzvah. And there weren't trains and planes. He didn't see his parents for 4 years. And he sat down, so Slovakia, not for lunch. And he just sat for 4 years learning. So by the time people were your age, they knew shas. I know it sounds crazy, but kids your age knew shas. Once you know shas already at a basic level, then you can start learning a little more deeply than you have to
all of a sudden show up in yeshiva out of that world after your 12th grade, is like, right now when you start learning, you just have a lot of ground to what would it be like? A lot of people like that, you guys basically go to modern Orthodox high schools. Anyone in from Riverdale? Okay, which school do you go to?
SNR.
SNR. What's your name?
Charlie.
So you ever heard of the Yeshiva Tells in Riverdale?
Yeah.
The Tells High School. I think. I don't know because I don't live in America. But from what I've heard, friends of yours, my friends, my kids your age in Tells, have already been through about 500 classes at your age. Now it comes to the cost of other things. I'm not saying what's better or what's worse. I'm just saying it's a whole different way to do it. I was very happy with my kids. For their bar mitzvah, they go through an entire Seder of Shas with them by the rules. Now, I didn't think they'd remember most of it, but I wanted to go through their system. I wanted them to have the language and the feel and the smell of Gemara in their system. So it is possible, right? Look at it differently. Think about the last year. Let's say you took not a quarter, but an eighth of the time you wasted last year. And you dedicated to Gemara. You probably know about 40, 50 more blot. The good news is, when you have the yeshiva, you'll have a quick time to make it up, because growth in the yeshiva is very exponential. But that's the answer to your question. When you're young, your mind's only sponges. You remember everything. When you're older, your minds become a little bit like rocks, and it's hard for you to stick it into the mold of the rocks. And when you're young, everything you reach, you're just absorbing it, like a sponge. That's what we're doing. Again, that's not where we're at yet in the community, that we're able to learn about the blot. Because people are not doing it. Yes, any other questions, guys? Yes.
A bit off topic. I was wondering if Rebbe would care to share one of his or his most fond or powerful memory of Rav Aaron.
Oh, that's easy. I just spoke about Rav Aaron. I'll tell him who Rav Aaron was. I spoke about him over Shabbos. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was my Rebbe for 32 years. Anyone here not hear Rav Aaron Lichtenstein? You've heard of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein? He was the Talmud of Rav Soloveitchik, who was the son of Rav Soloveitchik. I've never met anyone like that in my life. I'm absolutely convinced I will never again meet someone like that. World-class Talmud Chacham, world-class thinker, he had a PhD in English literature. Not that it was important, but that it taught me not to be frightened of this world, not to shy away from this world. I don't see demons, I don't see goblins, I'm not afraid of the world. I'm not intimidated by people that are intellectual, I'm not someone far smarter than them. I'm shaking my boots that I meet professors and bright people, because he was brighter than any of them. And he was the most pious and firm person. And he said, I mean, anything. Someone was asking, like, what a gadol is. So I'll tell you what a gadol is, okay? I'm going to mention, guys, here's a good mental experiment. 8 traits of Avodas Hashem. When I mention those 8 traits, I want you to associate each of those traits with someone you know. You ready? So I'm going to say a trait. You say, which person models that trait for you? Here it goes. Tefillah. Okay? Talmud Torah. Wisdom. Humility, selflessness, kindness. Oh, that's 6 or 7. Most people in life, when they engage in that experiment, they're patchworking. They met someone that represents Tefillah, someone that represents Torah, someone that represents Israel, someone that represents selflessness, social service. Any trait you say to me, I saw in this man. It's, to me, it's one big roof that encompasses all of those traits. That's the definition of a God. And when you have that, it's organic. You don't have to start looking and patchworking and saying, well, a little bit like this, a little bit like that. It all just works. You want to be like that person, obviously you're your own person, be like that person. And it changed my life. I didn't come to Israel thinking I want to live in Israel. The last thing I wanted to do was to be a Mechadech. Those are far, far off the field. But I just met someone, and I realized I'm standing in the presence of a person I could not have dreamed of, if you ask me. And he was such an excellent person in so many facets of his life, and it all came from his Talmud Torah, his Avodas Hashem, that it made me want to yearn. I want my life to be as rich and as lofty and as successful and as noble and as elegant as this man. There's something in this Torah that I have to get. I have to learn this Torah. I have to study, because I just see the impact. Like, if I ask you the question, who is the most impressive person you've ever met in your life that has been touched and shaped by Talmud Torah, or by Avodas Hashem in the broader sense? I'm sure you've met impressive people. But who's the most impressive person you've met, and you're asking, you know, how did that person become who they became? It's obviously because they're serving a Kodesh Baruch Hu, and the values and the Torah and the firm Christ obviously have something to do with that. And I just was drawn to it. I remember the story that changed my life. I've told some of the familiar before. It was Purim night.
my second year in yeshiva. And you remember in the Megillas Esther where Mordechai tells Esther about this genocidal plan, and Esther hasn't heard of it, and she tells Mordechai, get dressed, you can't walk around the king's gates and the king's courtyard in these sackcloths. And Mordechai says, please, Baruch Hashem, or should plead with him, and he should be seen with the brig. And what does Esther say? Well, I haven't really been cold for 30 days, and there's red tape and bureaucracy, I'm scared to go. And Mordechai basically says, you know, Hashem's going to save these people, you know, Hashem's going to save us. If you're in, you'll be saved. If not, you'll be discarded. Just make a choice right now. Do you want in on Jewish history? You're not wanting. Do you want to sacrifice so that you'll save us? You want to run away and flee your palace with your comforts and your luxuries. And Rav Aaron looked at him, was standing in the space better, so 500 people there. You could hear a pin drop. And he was shouting at the top of his lungs. He was a very quiet person. He was like a mouse. He was very, very humble. I can't tell you the amount of times I whacked Rav Aaron. Why did I hit Rav Aaron? Because let's say this is Rav Aaron. I'm sorry, let's say this is me, okay, and I'm Rav Aaron. He was so kind and so polite and so respectful. Let's say you're talking to your friend. He wouldn't come like, I am here. He would like hide out behind you, waiting for you to finish. So he'd like be behind me, creeping up on me, because he was so kind. He didn't want to disturb my conversation or my food. And then like, I didn't know he was even behind me. I'd turn around and spill my soup on him or hit him in the face. Like, that's how kind and that's how humble he was. But when he started speaking in front of us and representing Torah and Torah values, he kept shouting. It was like he was possessed by some other force. It was like a moral hurricane. All of a sudden, like, where did this come from? And he was shouting. And he was making believe he was Mordechai talking to Esther. And he was shouting in the name of Mordechai to Esther, challenging Esther, save your people. And he was repeating, I'll never forget this, 1986, 1985. Echbat lecha? Anyone speak Hebrew?
The matter?
Lo echbat lecha. Do you care? Do you not care? Echbat means you care. Echbat lecha? O lo echbat. Actually, lach, because it's a woman. Echbat lach? O lo echbat. He was screaming and saying it again and again. Do you care? Do you not care? And then I said to Rebbe, you got me. I want to be the type of person that cares about life. I want to be the type of person that lives for things beyond myself. You know what that's called? It's called an idealist. You know what success in life for me is when you come to yeshiva? Because everyone comes to yeshiva from different backgrounds, it goes off in different directions. If I meet you on the street in 25 years, one of my first questions to you, second question would be what you're learning. First question is, what ideal are you living for beyond yourself? Because if you script your life just for the next car, and for the next salary, and for the next trip to the restaurant, and for the next baseball game, you're leading a very sorry life, and you'll lead a very alone life. If you live for things beyond yourself, you know what that's called? Good story. This will end, because you guys got to get some sleep tonight, okay? A lot of times you guys come over and be in base members. You're unkind of the time. You say, Rebbe, I have a problem. I don't yet feel passionate about learning. You know what I'll say to them? I'll say, well, what do you feel passionate about? And most of the time the answer is, I don't know, potato chips, the Mets, Carlos and Gabby's, I don't know. So I say, you know what? You don't have a religious issue. You have a passion issue. You just don't know what passion is. So you first have to learn what passion is, and then you can be passionate about Torah. So what's passion? Here's what passion is.
You ready?
There are three things in my life I would be ready to die for. Hashem, my people, and my family. I don't have a death wish. I hope to live a long life. But these are the three things I try to live for. And if I really care about these three more than myself, then if push comes to shove, I'd have to be willing to sacrifice my life for them, or else I care about myself more than them. The death isn't the purpose. The death is just the proof. If you're not willing to die for something, you're not living for anything beyond yourself, because you're the most important person. And that takes time, takes maturity. Hashem created a self-preservational instinct in us so that we care about ourselves. And part of growing in life is to turn that around from myself, 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 into things that I live for beyond myself. That's called passion. No one here would give up their life for potatoes, I hope. No one here would give up life for the Mets. No one here would give up their life for friends, Carlos and Gabbies. So you're young, and I want you to think about giving up your life as a morbid thought. But the more you grow, the more you reach these ideals, well, these are things that are so important and more important than me. That's a very powerful way to lead your life. You're part of something more important than yourself. We can split the sentence on its end. It's a really exciting way to lead your life. I'm part of Jewish history. And therefore, if I have to, I die for Jewish history, which means that when I leave this earth, I'm still part of something. I'm part of the people who came before me, who built this people and sustained their faith through Bellas. And one day, I don't know, I left America close to, fewer than 30 years ago. And I had this great career, great opportunities. And why did I leave? And why did I throw it all away? Because I really wanted to raise my family in this country. Because one day, I wanted there to be hundreds of them, thousands of people that are my descendants that are in this country, living in this country. And I was willing to sacrifice my life, and sacrifice my comfort, and sacrifice my needs for something larger than myself. And that gives me great joy. And I don't care about what I'm going to eat tonight. I don't sit there. I don't care about what I'm building for the future. So that's what idealism is. Live for something beyond yourself. And you're starting down that path. And you have to meet people of passion, meet people of ideals, and those ideals are the ideals of the spark and fire. Okay? Any other questions, guys? Yes? What's your name?
Kevin Myers.
It can be anything under the sun. Doesn't have to be about Talmud Torah. So, go ahead, Kevin.
No, almost that. Like, our consciousness can't, like understand Hashem, prayer, or Olam Haba. In Olam Haba, we can't understand the choices we made in this world. Like, meaning it's like, how could we think that we had gone after this whenever this seems so obvious? Like, that's...
It's a little bit mortifying. Anyone here in this room say a Pasuk after Shmuel and Esrei? The first letter of the Pasuk is the first letter of your name, and the last letter of the Pasuk is the last letter of your name? There's a minhag to say, my name is Moshe. So every day in Tefillah, I say a pasuk from Mishlei that begins with Mem and ends with Hey. Mashem's base at the Kor v'tachpulas osim b'chamer. There's a list in some of the Siddur if you want. Do you know why you say that pasuk? Because when you get to Shemayim,
you're so afraid
of face the Yom Hadin, you're going to forget your name. Can anyone in this room imagine forgetting your name? Like, I forget a lot of my Torah, people, anniversary. I can't imagine forgetting my name. Evidently, that's how overwhelming that moment of truth, the great reveal is, that you'll be speechless and you'll lose your equilibrium and you'll even forget your name. And the point is, by having Torah in your system, you'll get the name back because Torah is so deeply embedded in you. That's the second part of the question. Has anyone ever had that where you did something really embarrassing, you got really flustered, and you fell or something, and like you just were so humiliated that you were paralyzed, you just couldn't move? Probably hasn't happened. Anyone know which story in Tanakh I'm describing? People that were so shocked by the offset between their own narrative and reality that they couldn't speak. What? A little bit. Very good. He's on the bed. Very good. But he doesn't say that Haman didn't speak. We can like read it in because he's a little bit flustered.
Like,
but who couldn't speak? And Rabbi Soloveitchik, remember, I want you to feel like there's a Masara. I'll leave it with the story of it. Rabbi Soloveitchik's great grandfather, the Beis Halevi, original Yosef Yosef Halevi Soloveitchik once said, and the Torah is giving us a little taste of what all of them are. So when we finally look at the movie of ourselves and we're watching our decision, then we say, oh my goodness, how could I make that decision? How could I make that decision? But you know what? You're going to make the decision again and so will I. And you have to have this balance between trying to do the right thing but also forgiving yourself and do the wrong thing. Because if you drive yourself into depression and you can't forgive yourself, you're not going to be successful. Guys, listen carefully to what I'm about to tell you before I tell you the story, okay? For your generation especially, you need to have ambition, you need to have drive, you need to have a work ethic, you need to have sacrifice, you need all those things. But the most important thing, which is so hard in this generation, is you have to be happy. And you have to have internal self-esteem. And that has to come first. And you're going to be driven, and I'm the machine, and I'm the Terminator, and I'm, you know what? This is a hard world for you. A hard world for you. And as a parent and as a Rebbe, I will always prioritize someone's happiness and self-esteem over whatever accomplishments. So start by, I was just talking to a boy the other day in yeshiva. He's leaving yeshiva for many years, and I said, your challenge in life is to be happy. And every time I speak with him, I'm going to ask you, are you a happy person?
And I want to hear how many blockchain are you learning. I don't want to hear, I know you're learning. I know you're dabbling. I don't care. I don't need that. I don't want that. I want to hear, are you happy and content? Because that's the foundation. And if the foundation is rickety, it will disappear. So I'll end you with this story just to give you a sense of what Masor is. Okay? Reb Lichtenstein was once giving us a shiur about some sugya. And he started, he told us something that, look at my hands, I'll trace it to you, that the Beis HaLevi said about it. About the sugya, the Beis HaLevi was a Yosef Dovah Levi Soloveitchik, a Rosh Hashiva in Volozhin, mid-19th century. And then Rav Aaron said, but his son, who was the Beis HaLevi's son? Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim Brisk, he argued with him. Okay, granted, the Beis HaLevi and Reb Chaim. Then he said, but Reb Chaim's son, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, argued with his father, Reb Chaim, and agreed with his grandfather, the Beis HaLevi. Okay, so that's the Beis HaLevi and Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, argued with Reb Chaim. But then Rav Aaron said, but the Rav told me that when he learned with his father of Moshe Soloveitchik, the Rav, he argued with his father of Moshe Soloveitchik, agreeing with his grandfather of Chaim, disagreeing with his great-grandfather the Beis HaLevi. It's only keeping score against the Beis HaLevi and Rav Moshe against Rav Chaim and the Rav. And then Rav Aaron said, well, when I learned this singing with the Rav, I showed Mariah for what his father of Moshe was saying, his grandfather, great-grandfather, the Beis HaLevi, said, okay, it's the Beis HaLevi, Rav Moshe, Rav Aaron, against Rav Chaim, and Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. And then Rav Aaron said, it's crazy. He said, last night I was preparing the shiur, my son Moshe, who's now the Rosh Hashiva of Rosh, whose name is Rav Moshe, came and brought me a raya to support what the Rav was saying, against what I was saying. Not like Rav Chaim. I'm saying, wow. Six generations of Torah, all the way back from Volozhin. I said two words to myself. And the most important two words, I belong. And he said, I belong is, I myself. And now I belong. And probably part of that Masara. It's not the only Masara. When I walk through this world, I don't feel like I'm insecure to that person or that person, he does this or he does that. You're your Masara, my Masara. I tell you, my Masara was all the way back to the days of the and that's what a good one needs to have confidence. So this summer, let's get the Masara. Let's get the trust. Let's get the passion. Don't take any pills, but we have to take a Tamiflu. Get the one-to-one. I'll see you guys next week, okay? Sunday night, we'll talk a little bit about Zionism. I'm going to give you a little bit about that. Sunday night, see you next week. Nice to meet you guys. Nice to meet you guys. Enjoy. Enjoy the week. If anyone's coming to Gush for Shabbos, I'll see you on Shabbos. It's a Shabbos only Gush. You don't need the place to come. Good food. Nice to meet you guys. Hashem made you and me emotion. And part of our emotion is great relationships. Hashem says, you know what? Take all those relationships, husband and wife, father and child, now it's a new subject, and superimpose them into our